Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Max. Coming up on the program today, Gauteng's 8 billion rand health debt crisis leaves patient care in the firing line. South Africa's cruise industry sets sail for growth, but can the momentum last? Artificial intelligence enters the ballot box with democracy itself at stake. And in a tougher world, can South Africa still win the investment it so urgently needs? It's Friday, the 29th of May. Gauteng's public health system is facing a supplier debt crisis that could directly threaten patient care. The provincial health department has acknowledged that it owes suppliers something in the region of 8 billion rand, while medical technology companies say they are being forced to continue supplying essential services, diagnostics and consumables despite months of delayed payments and procurement failures. The industry is warning now that hospitals cannot keep operating on the assumption that private suppliers will finance a broken system indefinitely. This is a real worry. In conversation now with Monica Lucas, who is vice chair of the South African Medical Technology Industry Association. Monica, welcome to you. And how close then is this crisis to affecting patient care in Gauteng hospitals?
Sadly to say, it already is affecting patients. And I think we are all aware that there are some suppliers who have already ceased supply to Gauteng Health, some to specific institutions and some across the board to the entire province. Due to the lack of payment that has been forthcoming over the last few months from the department.
So can we break it down? What essential medical supplies then are most at risk if suppliers can no longer carry this debt burden?
So Jeremy, MedTech covers a range from, it goes from syringes to a bandage to gloves to servicing of MRI machines or X-ray machines to knee implants, cardiovascular stents, to a whole host of other products. And every single one of these categories is potentially at risk.
These numbers, Monica, are absolutely staggering. If I've read this correctly, Gauteng Health owes suppliers something in the region of 8 billion rand. One's got to ask how a debt like this so big can build up without any consequences for senior officials, unless that, of course, is happening.
So, Jeremy, yesterday I was actually on the road with the MEC as she was hosting a roadshow for the major academic units within Gauteng. And it was very encouraging to hear her position on the situation. She is, I think she feels the way that the rest of us do. She's flabbergasted that this is even a reality that's being faced by the public sector. And she really was holding everybody to account yesterday during each of those meetings and made no secret of the fact that inefficiencies will not be tolerated. So I really hope that there is going to be a follow through on those promises and we'll see delivery on what's being asked of those officials at those institutions.
Monica, flabbergasted and hope, of course, are cheap currency. What would your association specifically like to see happen in the very short term?
We would like to see the debt that is owed to medical suppliers and all suppliers in Gauteng for that matter paid within the 30-day PFMA framework that is promised to us in the law. And unfortunately, that is not happening and it hasn't been happening for a very, very long time due to various reasons of system issues, human resource challenges and ultimately budget constraints. So at the moment, it's probably 8 billion and probably more, if I'm completely honest, seems like a very insurmountable number. But we are aware that the National Treasury has made commitments to try and help assist provinces to alleviate this debt problem that we are facing. But I don't know if it's going to be enough, is my honest answer.
Well, that's exactly the point. As you say, the department is meeting suppliers. But at this point, why should anyone believe this is going to produce results when previous commitments we know have failed?
100%. This is a conversation I think SAHMED's been having with various provinces and national health for over 10 years now. And we've seen some successes and some failures over the years, but unfortunately, this ball carries on rolling. And unless there is systemic change in the way in which budgets are managed and payments are done to suppliers to put them within that 30-day period, we are not going to see significant change happening anytime soon.
Monica, if this has been going on for more than a decade, why has your organization, do you think, failed to force meaningful action before now?
So, Jeremy, unfortunately, you know, SAHMED is a voluntary organization for medtech suppliers. And we have regular and ongoing engagements with National Treasury, National Health, the various different provinces. But unless there is effective will to change within the governmental structures and institutions, there's a limited ability of what we as an association, from suppliers, what we are able to do. And from an ethics perspective, as medtech suppliers, we're very, very aware of our impact on patient care. And we are aware that we are responsible for helping to deliver those patient outcomes to the public within the realms of South Africa.
And that's the trump card, surely, that the authorities hold, is that they know you're going to hold that line.
That is unfortunately the situation, and suppliers have to make that decision independently as to how they are going to continue to operate their businesses, whether they're going to continue to operate in the public space or not. And those are the choices that some companies are facing at the moment.
I just want to circle back to the reasons. If I heard you correctly, is it fundamentally a cash shortage? Is it just procurement failure, as you alluded to? Or are you also suggesting, Monica, just plain administrative incompetence?
All of the above. We are very aware that budget has been reduced significantly over the past few years. There are massive budget constraints facing the health sector. Everyone's aware of the challenges that happened at Tembisa from a corruption scandal perspective, and certainly errors and corruption and inefficiencies in the way in which goods are procured has a major impact on how the money is spent. And ultimately, yes, there is certainly the administrative failure when it comes to the accountability at the institution level as to how they are spending their money and where they are spending their money.
So you've engaged with the MEC on this issue as early as yesterday. Have you pushed for any kind of resolution timeline here?
So she has committed to having this resolved and the 8 billion paid by the end of 2026, by December 2026, with accountability follow-up that she has requested by November. And the roadshow is continuing on, I believe, next week as well to some of the smaller institutions to identify shortcomings in those spaces. And we are going to certainly try our best to hold her as accountable for the promises that she's made yesterday, as well as the accounting officers at the various institutions and the promises that they've made to all the suppliers.
Monica Lucas, that seems to me to be a very generous timeline. If it's elongated for too long, surely some suppliers, particularly smaller ones, would risk going out of business.
100%. So they have committed to settling suppliers' debt that I think is below R1 million within the next 30 days. So hopefully those smaller SMEs and EME businesses will see that payment relief in the short term. One of the biggest challenges, Jeremy, that is being seen though in the sector is the lack of purchase orders, which is impacting the ability to actually handle the budget effectively and pay suppliers on time. We're experiencing delays of months at a time due to lost paperwork and staff inefficiencies that are compounding this issue. So when I say, you know, we've got that R8 billion that we anticipate is owed to suppliers, that figure is possibly significantly more, because there is so much still sitting there, which is still waiting for purchase orders, which will only then become invoiced.
And how close are you to taking legal action if there is no credible repayment plan that is honoured?
So SAHMED has explored legal action options, which we continue to do, and that is something that we will implement should that need arise.
Monica Lucas, thank you very much indeed. Vice Chair of the South African Medical Technology Industry Association.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's cruise industry is claiming strong growth, with MSC Cruises reporting more than 85,000 passengers on 37 local sailings over the past season. But I think beyond the headline numbers, important questions remain about who really benefits, whether ports and tourism infrastructure can sustain further growth, and how vulnerable the sector is to economic pressure and also health scares at sea. Well, let me try and pull all of that together for you. I'm in conversation with Ross Volk, who is Managing Director at MSC Cruises South Africa. Ross, let's start with a big number and welcome to you. 85,000 passengers. It sounds impressive, but are you able to quantify what that number really means for the South African economy? Is it significant?
Thanks, Jeremy. It's a great privilege to be on the show. And yes, it is very significant. Cruising, both within South Africa and globally, represents an incredible force multiplier for the economy, because you have such a big volume of passengers arriving at any one point in time that kickstart the local economy. You know, from purchasing, so 500 tons of meat every 2 weeks, 20,000 lettuces a week, fuel, which is all procured within the local form because it's fresh produce and it's also on demand. So it has a significant impact into the downstream impact of the economy. You've got 85,000 people traveling by air to Durban or to Cape Town. You've got people going by road, which has that added knock-on effect. So cruising, for me, globally represents a significant impetus to an economy, and within South Africa as well, it's an even bigger important part of growing our coastal cities' economies in these difficult times.
So let me pick you up on the force multiplier argument then. How much of that money, are you able to quantify it, spent on a cruise actually stays in local ports within tourism businesses and communities rather than just flowing offshore?
Well, from a South African perspective with MSC, we have a local office that we employ 500 people that services the globe in terms of contact centers, as well as our, you know, expenses and everything like that. So a significant proportion, I don't have the exact quantity, but a significant portion of what we earn is stays within the country and benefits the local communities. The other cruise lines that are not prevalent and or don't have a permanent establishment in South Africa, I can't really comment on what that does from their side. But certainly from a South African, an MSC perspective, we have a strong footprint in South Africa, and we keep a large proportion of that money within South Africa to run our operations and to pay for everything locally. So you're probably looking in the region of, you know, a couple of hundred million rand that stay within the economy.
Ross, you describe, and this is from a passenger perspective now, you describe cruising as value-based travel. In, though, this financially stretched economy that we're operating in right now, is it becoming mainstream, or do you think it is still for some time going to be a middle-class luxury?
I think it's becoming very mainstream. I mean, I spend a lot of time down at the port talking to our guests and just overseeing how operations work. And I see a wide diversity of South Africans, from your sort of 1%ers through your middle class to those that have saved up for a couple of years to go on this cruise. And that's their holiday that they're taking, a dream holiday of a lifetime. And so I think it's very mainstream. It's across the board, and people need to look at it from the perspective of being the best value proposition holiday, because you don't have any ancillary costs outside of drinks, which you can cap. You have everything covered, your entertainment, your food, your hotel moves for you, and you have your accommodation. And you don't have any of these other ancillary costs that you pick up every time you go on a holiday, especially with kids, where you've got to pay, you know, three or four times a day for meals and drinks and things like that. Everything's incorporated.
Ross, I think I'm correct in saying that Gauteng would be your biggest source market, but there is risk surely attached to that. Does it not make demand vulnerable to airfares, fuel costs, and again, broader household financial pressure?
Yeah, so the Highveld, what I would consider the sort of Highveld area, is our biggest market. And you are correct in terms of the risks associated with airfares. But we then engage with airlines to provide a holistic package from an end-to-end solution. So you arrive, we've got an air, land-based hotel, and then climb on the ship as part of an overall package that does have some preferential rates. Fuel costs, well, obviously, you know, if you are driving, it does have an impact. But, you know, given the value proposition that you have, you want to go on holiday regardless. And so you'd have to pick the best destination. And cruising is that best destination from the overall value proposition it presents.
Ross, Durban and Cape Town's ports, do you believe they are genuinely equipped to handle sustained cruise growth? Or is infrastructure still a constraint and, again, another risk that you've got to evaluate?
It is a risk within Southern Africa and Africa as a wider destination. Our infrastructure is something that we've been calling for development with the national government for a long time. The Durban Cruise Terminal was designed with longevity in mind, so it was designed to cater for an increasing volume of passengers up to about 10,000 people a day. Cape Town is a challenge from a wind perspective in that it has some significant issues relating to the vagaries of the wind, but we are obviously in talks to it. But it is a big area of risk that we need to look at, and it's not only within the port infrastructure. It's also talking about what infrastructure exists in the port cities to facilitate the movement of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 passengers a day to the respective destinations that they want to go and see. So there's a wider conversation to be had about the port facilities. So although the port facilities may be, you know, world class, particularly in Durban's case, you have a situation where the port, the surrounding infrastructure needs to be also taken into consideration. And I think that we need to have a national dialogue in terms of how we integrate our plan from a tourism perspective to grow infrastructure within Southern Africa to facilitate the growth of cruising, because it has a huge impact. I mean, globally, it's a $100 billion business.
Ross, let me pivot from infrastructure to health, if I can. Obviously, you would have watched the recent Hunter virus outbreak. It was on another cruise ship, and it was not an MSC vessel. Let me make that absolutely clear. But an incident like this surely would be damaging to public confidence in cruise holidays.
Jeremy, I think, yes, it wasn't our ship. Thank you for clarifying that. Yes, to an extent, although the protocols on board ships are quite significant in terms of how they manage and respond to these type of crises. And, you know, this was probably unavoidable in terms of what happens if these passengers have climbed on an aircraft and flown all the way back to Europe. We would have had this similar challenge in the space. We need to respond practically and with the right assessment of the risks associated with it in terms of how we go about doing it. So, you know, I think since COVID, we've learned a lot from a cruising perspective. We had great protocols previously. There is very strong protocols relating to health on board. We have medical facilities that are able to manage almost every emergency. So, you know, I think any travel would be impacted. But, you know, we've got the means to manage it. It's not about the crisis avoiding it. It's also about how you manage it. And that's one of the most important factors for us.
And Ross, just a final question. If I understand this, you're bringing in a new vessel next season. Is that because demand is growing or simply because you need a different product to keep prices competitive?
Two aspects. One, we have a global fleet planner that we put in place, and we look at what ships are best designed for the respective canvases that we have globally. And we look at which ships have been requested from the other locales. And we've made the decision that that Armania, given her, she has never been to South Africa, would create an element of newness. But it's also one of the better ships from an outside deck facility perspective for South Africa, given our sunny weather and the predisposition of South Africans to enjoying beach holidays and enjoying themselves in the sun. That's kind of what we've designed the canvas around in terms of looking at what the best option for South Africa is.
Ross Volk, thank you very much indeed. He is the Managing Director of MSC Cruises South Africa.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, I don't need to tell you that artificial intelligence is increasingly shaping the way people receive information, form political opinions, and engage with elections. And as you well know, it can produce convincing deep fakes, it can spread disinformation at real speed, and target voters with personalized political messaging, and give governments powerful new tools of surveillance and control. But the danger may run deeper than just fake news. As algorithms begin to predict our preferences and make decisions on our behalf, one's got to ask, are citizens at risk now of slowly surrendering the very agency that democracy depends on? Well, someone who has applied their mind to this very important issue, particularly ahead of our local government elections, is Bronwyn Williams, partner at Flux Trends. Bronwyn, a very warm welcome. And ahead of our local election at the end of the year, is there a sense that AI could be a genuine threat to a free and fair poll?
Yes, these are certainly comments that are being made in the media. There's certainly conversations that are being had locally and internationally and multinationally. Of course, these are issues that the UN is looking at too, that there does seem to be this perception there is a real and credible threat that we can be influenced and manipulated by artificial intelligence, whether that be through deep fakes or myths or disinformation that is increasingly convincing looking, because of course now it's full on multimedia, but also increasingly personalized. I know this is something we've been speaking about for quite some time, but in the digital world, we don't actually know that you're seeing the same thing I'm seeing, that you're seeing the same message that I'm seeing. These sorts of, shall we call them propaganda campaigns, can be increasingly targeted, tailored, and increasingly effective, because of course they can self-learn. This is of course what AI does too. It learns what you respond to, it adapts. So it's these effective, which means they affect your emotions as well as just your brain, but also dynamic advertising that does make us feel increasingly uncomfortable. But there's another layer to that, which I'd like to look at, and that is that even as those messages we get through our social media feeds, through the mainstream media, wherever we're listening, we have to, of course, understand that we're still making the choices ultimately. We have the choice to adopt those information, to respond to it, or not. And I suppose that's really the point that you're making in your opening comments, that we are increasingly seeing, certainly on the consumer space and unfortunately also on the citizen space, people wanting to absolve themselves of the responsibility, the tedium, the cost of making decisions. It's much easier to make a decision or to allow something or someone else to make that decision for you. So it's comforting, it's easy, it's the path of least resistance, but we do know where that ends up.
Bronwyn, I'm going to ask you a very baby boomer question here, but haven't politicians always used propaganda? What do you think makes AI fundamentally more dangerous now than, say, 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because that's a point that I also make. As much as these tools can perhaps manipulate us and propagandize us better than we had in the past, propaganda is a well-known, well-studied tool, just like regular advertising, only we apply propaganda to the political space rather than the consumer space. There's a well-known science of how to get us to do more of this and less of that. And it has been adopted and embraced by people long before AI was even a term, or even before the word robot had been invented. So in some ways, a lot of our panic, I'm certainly seeing, might be misplaced, that we put too much faith into the ability of others to manipulate strangers rather than focusing on the choices that we're making in our individual lives with regards to our actual agency and decision making. This for me is a much bigger issue than some bad actors out there trying to manipulate you, your friends, your kids using fancy images on the internet. Sure, we can talk about that, but what is perhaps more interesting is this bigger idea of peaceful sort of transition from making our own choices to allowing machines who seem to make better choices than us often, or at least that's what we are being led to believe, are quite peacefully, deliberately, by our own volition. And this, of course, reminds me of a conversation I had with a wonderful local technologist and entrepreneur and academic, Adam Pantanowitz, probably around 10 years ago, where I remember sitting in a coffee shop on a quite cold May day, much like this, quite a long time ago, talking about what could happen when it comes to technology. And this idea that increasingly, if we actually think about what democracy is, which is trying to get a consensus out of people, that maybe technology would be able to do that better than us queuing up to make a little X on a box. And his idea was, and at that stage, he was experimenting with all sorts of mind reading technology, or at least the early nascent days of that, using EEG helmets and things. He had these visions of a world where technology could assume or predict what was best for you and me and everyone else, and come up with the consensus view, bypassing the need for us to elect fallible human politicians at all. And increasingly, this is a view that more and more people are subscribing to, this idea that our politicians are obviously flawed. In our case, I've just spent a week at the book fairs talking about crime and corruption in our country. Would it be that bad to defoil the choices that are currently being made by obviously flawed human beings, either at the top, the elected officials, or by our flawed peers who choose the wrong people in our estimation? Would it not be better just to let technology make that decision very democratically for us, looking at all the needs of all of us and coming up with the machine-perfect solution? And this, for me, is a lot bigger topic for us to think about for the future than some bot farm in Russia trying to get us to tell us what to think using bad graphics and LinkedIn posts.
Bert Bronwyn, back to the bot farm, though. Is there a tipping point or a precipice point where AI-driven surveillance can turn a functioning democracy into an authoritarian state? And what would it take us to get to that point if we're fairly close to it?
Well, not much. I think we are very close to it in many senses. We have already willingly given up our privacy in exchange for convenience. This is not some great conspiracy taking place by some cabal somewhere in the universe controlling all of us, but rather it's just the sum total of all of us making little choices, either to increase what we're getting out of systems for cost reasons, for convenience reasons, just take a little bit of pressure off that immense cognitive load, or for increasingly for security reasons. I mean, we know in South Africa, we can just look out on our streets, there's Vumatel cameras that we've begged to have put up to monitor our every step. In the US, they have their Ring systems where people have willingly traded away their neighbor's privacy as well as their own for a little bit of a sense of security. We have largely given away most of our space. All that's really left is our cognitive domain at this point. And even that, there are all sorts of patents on the table, including Apple's latest EarPods patents that are looking at precognitive thought. Are they trying to read your mind quite before that thought forms by assessing the tiny little micro sort of movements in your jaw, that sort of just preempting what you say before you say it to try and get a sort of edge on what we're thinking. And that domain is probably the last domain we have to have left. It is not currently surveilled one way or another. We have essentially invited this in. It's not been imposed upon us. But it has led us to a point where effectively we are living with all the mechanics of basically a cybernetic state, where we rely on technology to check our own decisions before we make them, to check our writing before we publish it, right? To check our decisions and what we put in our basket, if it matches with the bonus points our insurers are putting out. All those multiple little nudges do combine into a world where perhaps this totalitarian state isn't some future nightmare, but rather a lived, quite convenient, quite comfortable reality. And that's something we have to sit with.
And that is the debate. Can artificial intelligence strengthen democracy or destroy it? Bronwyn Williams, partner at Flux Trends, thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The following interview is brought to you by the RMB Think Summit. Business leaders are navigating a world of heightened geopolitical tensions, shifting trade relationships, tighter capital, and growing uncertainty about where to invest for growth. And for South Africa, I think the question is whether the country can turn its myriad challenges into real opportunities and then persuade investors that it remains a credible destination for long-term capital. The RMB Think Summit brings together local and international leaders to explore how businesses and economies can respond to volatility with confidence and fresh thinking. Ahead of the event, I'm in conversation now with Isaiah Mtlanga, who's an economist at RMB. Isaiah, what then is, in your opinion, the biggest source of uncertainty right now that is confronting business leaders and investors? I know it's a long list, but what's the big concern in your opinion?
Thanks, Jeremy. At this point in time, we have a Middle East shock that have driven oil prices higher, inflation starting to rise across the globe, but also in South Africa, which means it's going to be a tax on economic growth, both from an impact on the consumer, but also the response of central banks, particularly our own South African Reserve Bank, that we expect is going to start acting and hike interest rates, putting more pressure on the economy. That is the external shock. But we also have our own issues. The political cycle is also putting uncertainty on economic policy and the reforms that we have been undergoing through over the last 3 to 4 years. Are they going to continue? That's the big question.
It's a very uncertain environment. And in this world that you outline of higher risk and more cautious capital, what then, in your opinion, still makes South Africa investable?
It's what we have been doing over the last 3 to 4 years, opening up critical sectors of the economy from energy to logistics, water sector is coming, digital space to the private sector, where government is essentially saying they need the private sector to be part and parcel partners that are going to invest in these critical sectors to introduce competition, but also a level of governance that is going to make the space a playing level field for investors, both domestic and external. And the more interesting part is the investment cycle has been led by domestic investors, which means offshore investors will have more confidence seeing domestic investors invest. But also the political cycle with the formation of GNU in the last general election, it has remained intact. A few set of economic policies which are supported across the board of all political parties that are in the GNU, which is why the local government elections that are coming up on the 4th of November is very important. And this is, we will have a panel that will be discussing the potential outcome or what the local government is going to bring about from a policy perspective and what it means for investment going forward, which is going to be available to the public.
I want to reflect on the conference in a little more detail in a moment, but just against the backdrop that you've outlined, South Africa, I think is fair to say, still battles weak growth and high unemployment. Is there anything that is going to convince investors that a genuine turnaround is underway, or do you think that those noises are already being heard?
No, the noises are already being heard. Last year, we had S&P upgrade South Africa's credit rating in over nearly two decades. The last time we've seen a credit rating upgrade, and it still left the outlook on positive, which means the next action is likely to be an upgrade again. A week ago, we had Moody's also change the outlook to positive, which means the next action is also going to be an upgrade. Now we have two credit rating agencies that have affirmed what we've been saying. Economic reforms have been, being implemented. It's no longer whether we are going to see implementation. It has changed to, are we going to sustain the reforms that we are seeing, which means implementation is already happening. And an external validation from credit rating agencies actually is very important for investors. Bond markets have already responded. The cost of funding for the state, but also for the general economy as a whole, given that markets do reference government bond yields, they've also declined over the last 18 months or so. That is investors voting with their own money, saying we no longer require as much return to compensate for the risks, and therefore they have reduced that required return, which means they are seeing the changes that are taking place from a reform perspective. We just need to sustain these over the next couple of years.
Isaiah, then to the RMB Think Summit. It's built around turning volatility into opportunity. What does RMB hope then that leaders will take away from the number of conversations that will be held?
First is to recognize the external shocks, the change in the global macro environment, geopolitical environment, and how it impacts on Africa, how it impacts on South Africa and the economic growth potential. Secondly, is to recognize the opportunities that lie in that global reset. So here is where opportunities lie in South Africa and in the continent. And then third, it is how to actually take those opportunities in a practical way, going forward. And then the last one is, a call to action, really, to say until domestic investors, policymakers act and act decisively, we shouldn't expect foreign investors to be part of what we want to see, which is a recovery in our own economic growth. So we have to see action starting here at home, before we expect it from offshore investors. And we are seeing that action taking place. It's slow, but it is happening.
So what would you then look ahead over the next year or two that would give you confidence post the conference that South Africa is starting to attract the capital it needs for jobs and growth?
What we're looking for post the summit is a political cycle that puts economic growth at the center of how they campaign, how they debate. That's the first one. Secondly, a commitment to continuation of the economic reforms that are ongoing currently. Speed them up and openness to talking to the private sector as partners in this economic growth ambitions. And then, thirdly, it is one voice between government and the private sector to say economic growth investment is what we're trying to drive. Put a mark on the cent to say we need 3% economic growth at a minimum that is communicated across government, across the private sector, because any economic growth that is less than that is not going to reduce unemployment rate to the levels that we want to see.
Isaiah Mhlanga is Chief Economist, Head of Research at Rand Merchant Bank, and the RMB Think Summit is the company's flagship thought leadership platform, convening global and African perspectives to examine the forces reshaping capital markets, trade architecture, and long-term growth. It takes place in Cape Town next week. This interview was brought to you by the RMB Think Summit. And that is our program for today and for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.